For over 10 years, VOC Nation has taken listeners behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Our hosts are not only experts on the business, but have lived in the business. Subscribe and hear weekly podcasts from hosts like legendary pro wrestling journalist Bill Apter, former Impact Wrestling star Wes Briscoe, former WWE and AWA broadcaster Ken Resnick, former WWE and TNA star Shelly Martinez, former WCW star The Maestro, NWA legend The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, and much more. VOC Nation programming is free on most major podcasting apps, including iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Radio.com. And video podcast and bonus content is available on Patreon for as low as $3 a month. What are you waiting for? Head to VOCNation.com and dig into the most comprehensive podcast network built for pro wrestling fans. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at VOC Nation Wrestling Network and follow us on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Another episode of the Stadium Journey Podcast, proud to be part of the VOC Nation family of podcasts. Stadium Journey is more than just a great podcast, it's a lifestyle. Our website, stadiumjourney.com, contains over 2,500 stadium reviews, news items, and great features, perfect for the traveling sports fan. In addition to the website, we are all over social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. Like, follow us, comment, do it everywhere. Stadium Journey Podcast is the perfect companion while you're on a road trip. Just type in VOC Nation Radio Network on your podcast search app or search for us on Spotify. There we are. In addition, all of our old video podcasts are on the Stadium Journey YouTube channel. Perfect for a binge watch. If you happen to be watching this episode at a later date, the Stadium Journey Podcast streams live on twitch.tv/danlaw83. Tuesday night today. And now, let me take a second and introduce our starting lineup for tonight. We've got Dave Cotney here with us. You can follow him online at ProFan9. Mark Viquez can be found at Ballpark Hunter. Dan Calachico, the above-average comedian, is here. You can follow him at DanMoore83. And I am Paul Baker. You can follow me at PuckmanRI. And tonight, we are excited to be switching gears. I mean, we've been talking about baseball quite a bit lately. And it's not that we don't love talking about baseball, but that's not what we're all about. What we're all about here at Stadium Journey, there is room for all the sports here on the Stadium Journey Podcast. And tonight, we are pleased to be joined by Pete McGinty, season ticket holder with the Columbus Crew SC. I got to get used to saying it that way, I guess, huh? Yep. And author of the book Accidental Heroes. Pete, welcome to the podcast. We're glad to have you.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to be here.
All right. So, I'm going to jump into the only thing I know right now about the Columbus Crew, and that is the rebrand that just went down. What are your thoughts about that?
I don't know anything about that. What are you talking about? that was a bad attempt at a joke. If you live in Columbus like I do, it's all that is being talked about. My wife and I went to the Crew game on Saturday. We had no idea it was happening or anything. And the Nordec section of the stadium, which is usually where all the supporter groups sit, was almost empty. And my wife said, why is that? Certainly there's COVID, there's distancing and everything. And she goes, why is that almost empty? And I said, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's weird. The soccer fans, Crew fans are socially conscious. Maybe they're kind of COVID fear. Who knows? But then Sunday learned about the rebranding and learned about the Nordec was actually protesting the game because they had a sneak peek of it on Friday. And so when the new logo was introduced, the new badge was introduced on Sunday through social media, a real grainy, bad image of it that somebody must have snapped on their cell phone from a sweatshirt they were showing or something. All hell broke loose. I mean, it just was, and it hasn't stopped since. I mean, if you go to social media, it's crazy. It's crazy. I'll just to summarize, there has not been a lot of support for it here among Crew fans. So
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think I've even seen anybody say anything positive about it, because you took this wonderful logo, which I would consider probably one of the best in MLS, perfect example of how they rebranded properly a few years ago, and you come up with this really dull, boring, vapid symbol to a team that prides itself as being the first team in MLS. So how much money do you think went into rebranding efforts and demographics to come up with what they came up with?
I have no idea. Everyone's trying to figure out who did it.
Yeah.
And the rumor is that it was a firm in England who has a relationship with MLS. So if that is indeed true, then that maybe leads to another bit of speculation in terms of what the MLS's role in this may have been. But, you know, I happen to work in branding and marketing and advertising, and, you know, rebrands like this can cost certainly hundreds of thousands of dollars. And when you talk about research and concepting and testing and so forth, I don't think there was a lot of testing with this particular mark, but there was research but I have no idea what they invested in terms of development. I will say that they're ready to go, though. I mean, they've got the merchandise ready. They're delivering merchandise to media. There was no turning back for them. And even down by the new stadium that's under construction, the wrapping around the fencing and everything is all now the new Columbus SC look and everything. So they were ready to go. They had everything ready. And so they weren't planning on turning back.
Yeah, it's a
– I find it interesting that you said that it's coming from a firm in England. So, is the Crew playing at home this weekend? No, they're playing tomorrow, aren't they?
They're not playing at home for, I think, 3 weeks.
Oh, okay. So,
yeah.
In 3 weeks, are we to expect like a Manchester United situation? Like, is the Nordic gonna break into the stadium and send the flares everywhere and stop the game from happening? And
I think it's possible. First of all, I should clarify that the most I've been able to find out is that we think it came from England. We may learn it didn't, but if it didn't, no one's willing to raise their hand and say we did that. I think it's more likely that the Nordic and the diehard fans are going to protest. And it'll probably be outside the stadium, but not come in. And if they do come in, the TIFOs probably will not have very positive messages on them. I mean, that's the prevalent sentiment online right now. I mean, no one's talking about what happens when they come back to Columbus, but I don't think anyone's thought that far ahead. But it's an angry mob. It's an angry mob.
Go ahead, Mark.
So they did exactly what they didn't want to do, tick off their supporters and diehard fans.
You know, I mean, I know we're going to talk about the Save the Crew movement and how the team was saved and so forth. I mean, it'd probably be good to jump back there just for a second. You know, this group of fans, had it not been for this group of fans, the Crew would not be here. They'd be in Austin, right? And they'd be there now. And so what these fans did to create this movement and to put their blood, sweat, tears, and their own money behind the things they did, I mean, they did their own fundraising and everything, was just remarkable. And the foundation of what they did was in part because of this mantra, respect your roots, okay? Columbus, the first MLS team in the league. Columbus, the Crew Stadium, was the first soccer-only stadium in the country. And so it's the roots of the club, but it's also the roots of MLS. And so they leaned on that very heavily. And so when the new ownership group came in, I mean, they were very adamant that they are not going to change the logo. They're not going to change the – well, they didn't say they were going to change the logo ever, but they said, you know, Columbus is here to stay. We understand community. You know, they did say the Crew are not going anywhere. And they built such a relationship with between the Save the Crew movement and the fans and the ownership. I mean, it's been so strong. And it's Jimmy and Dee Haslam, who own the Cleveland Browns, and a man named Dr. Pete Edwards. Those are the three owners. They make up the ownership group. And Dr. Pete is an orthopedic surgeon here, and he actually has been the crew physician for 26 years. So his roots go back to the day one with the crew. I mean, he is as big a fan as there is, and he was so instrumental in pulling the Haslams into this. And they really brought the majority of the money. But so the whole idea of the roots, respect the roots, and then the relationship that was built between the ownership group and the fans, and there just seemed to be this level of trust that, you know, the Save the Crew movement fought against the machine. You know, they fought against the league, they fought against Garber, they fought against Anthony Precourt, the previous owner, and they won, right? So now I think they feel like the new machine, right, has now screwed them over, right? They have betrayed them. And, you know, they came to the dance and their date went off in a different direction. And so I think there's this sense of betrayal and anger. And it's been, you know, you're coming off of the saving the team, coming off of the MLS Cup, winning the Cup, coming off of building a new stadium, which is going to open on July 3rd. I mean, it's spectacular. The excitement here and also adding only better players to our team, an already good team now, certainly better. There's nothing but brightness in the future, right? And then this happens. And it just, I will speak for them, and I can see all sides of this to some degree. But, I mean, I think the fans felt like it was just a dagger in their heart after all they did and after all they'd been through and the amount of trust they had in this ownership group and the level of affinity they had back and forth. I mean, Dee Haslam was on a podcast, I think it was this last week or the week before, raving about the fans, raving about the community, raving about the relationship she had with the fans and talking about how the fans call her Sweet Dee and just, you know, just loves the community. And it's just, so my heart breaks for everybody involved here. I just, you know, it's just so unfortunate. And I think it was just, in the end, I think you could say it was a miscalculation would be an understatement. But now we are where we are, and how they get through this together, I think, is anybody's guess.
So let's, for our fan, for our listeners out there who aren't Major League Soccer fans or don't have a strong knowledge of the Columbus Crew, let's do a little timeline here, okay? So Pete, you tell me where I got this wrong, okay? So the Columbus Crew, one of the 10 founding members of Major League Soccer in 1994. I think it's fair to say it was a bit of a surprise choice. Their original owners, Lamar Hunt and Clark Hunt. Lamar Hunt, instrumental in making this league happen. I think he owned three teams at one point. And Clark Hunt was his son. I remember when I went to see the Crew, there was a huge statue of Lamar Hunt outside. Really, without Lamar Hunt, this league doesn't take off, I don't think. The Crew play their first game in 96, April of 96. They play at Ohio Stadium, home of course, those Ohio State people.
Or as we like to say, the Ohio State Buckeyes.
I might be a Michigan fan, but whatever.
Oh, really? You might be. Okay.
I might be. 1999, the Crew Stadium opens. It's the first soccer-specific stadium for professional soccer in the States. And Lamar Hunt looks at it as the key to making this whole thing work, that this league needs more soccer stadiums and less football stadiums. They're successful. They win the Supporters' Shield in 2004. They win the MLS Cup in 2008. 2013, after the passing of Lamar Hunt, they're purchased by Anthony Precourt, who, interestingly enough, I think it's fair to say he's the son of an oil man, just like Lamar Hunt was. I think he's got some financial things going. And then in October 2017, everything changes. And I remember we even talked about this on the podcast when we were first starting out, that he is announcing that they're going to move the team to Austin, Texas.
Well, you're nearly right. So the announcement that hit was a Grant Wall tweet. Grant Wall is the soccer writer for Sports Illustrated, sportsillustrated.com, and very knowledgeable about what's going on. And he tweeted, I think it was, if I'm guessing, I think it was like 10:52 p.m. on October 16th, 2017, unless a downtown stadium deal can be reached in Columbus soon, the Precourt is taking the crew to Austin, Texas, or something to that effect. And that was a total shock to crew fans. And so that night changed a lot of things. That night, they did not have any idea that Precourt was planning this or potentially that this could happen. So sorry to interrupt you, but yeah.
Yeah. And we talked before about how Austin is really kind of an interesting choice because outside of being in very different climates, of course, Austin is a very similar city to Columbus, big university capital of the state. You got the same sort of demographics where you got, young professionals at the university and at the state house and all that, easily overshadowed by bigger cities in the state. I think it's fair to say that Austin is not a better climate for soccer in the summer. That's just my opinion, but I don't know. Sitting out in Texas heat for that doesn't sound fun.
I will say, correct you, Columbus actually is the biggest city in Ohio, but
okay.
A lot of people don't know that, but that's okay. See, I got to – yeah, that's good. So the Austin thing. So one of the things that gave crew fans some comfort when Precourt bought the team was that when Clark Hunt, when the Hunt family and Lamar Hunt had passed away by now, when he sold the team in 2013 to Precourt, there was a clause in the contract that he had to keep the team in Columbus for 10 years, okay? So crew fans, in 2017, you're five years into this deal. You're not thinking there's any chance that that's even on the horizon, right? What crew fans didn't know was that Anthony Precourt had also put this kind of secret clause in the contract for Precourt that if the team proved to be not successful in Columbus, he could move the team to Austin, Texas. So no one knew about that. It's now known as the Austin Clause, right? And nobody knew anything about that. So Austin hadn't even applied for a franchise. San Antonio had paid their franchise fee of $5 million. San Antonio had bought a stadium and were getting ready to renovate it. They were ready to get the next team in Texas. And the MLS said, well, between Austin and San Antonio, you're both not getting a team, so it's one or the other. So San Antonio thought they had every correct path to getting a team. They didn't know about the Austin Clause either. So this Austin Clause thing became – so what's going on now with the commissioner of the league, Don Garber, in Precourt, where Garber made this deal that he could just take this team and take it to Austin, a city who – not that they didn't want a team, but they'd never expressed the kind of interest in, paying the franchise fee and putting money together for a stadium. And so they were probably on a more positive side of ambivalent than not. But, yeah.
And tons of expansion happening in the league at this time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the MLS is getting rich with expansion fees, franchise expansion fees. And the other thing about Austin was when Precourt talked about the efficacy of taking the team to Austin, why Austin was an attractive market. To your point earlier, Dave, he said, you know, it's a growing city. It's an up and coming city. It's a great city for young professionals. You know, it's the state capital. It's a big university. It's this, it's that. And he was basically describing Columbus, except for the fact of saying it's just way too hot in Austin and Columbus is a much better climate. Maybe that's a matter of opinion too, but.
So, that's the point really where the Save the Crew movement kicks into gear. Now, there was one other kind of legal part that I find curious. So in March of 2018, the Attorney General of Ohio and the City of Columbus filed suit against Precourt and I believe Major League Soccer because there was a state law that they put in which basically said that teams could not move without giving teams that benefited from publicly funded stadiums could not move without giving 6 months' notice and the opportunity for local ownership to buy it. And this was put on the books basically as a result of the Browns picking up and just moving to Baltimore. How much of a factor do you think this was? Because it was totally untested. Fascinating if you're a lawyer, I think. Do you think this really had any effect on any of this story?
Yeah, there's no question it did. You know, the law was called the Modell Law, named after former Browns owner Art Modell, who, and I happen to be a huge Cleveland Browns fan, so that ripped my heart out at the time when he moved the team to Baltimore. So it was called the Modell Law, and it said exactly what you said, Dave, in terms of, you know, an owner can't do that without 6 months' notice. So, the thing is, this law was written and it was on the books, but no one was thinking about it. I mean, nobody really, I mean, even the crew, they didn't know about it. Save the Crew team didn't know about it. Some city leaders didn't know about it. It was a state senator, his name's Mike Duffy, out of a suburb of Columbus, who remembered this or came across it or something. And he called Mike DeWine, our attorney general, who's now our governor, and he said, hey, there's this, about this thing called the Modell Law, and maybe, you know, it could help us here and so forth and so on. I don't even know if Governor DeWine knew about it at the time. But when they filed it, what happened was there was never a specific date given to the city to allow a new ownership group to come to be. So the 6 month, so you got to give the city 6 months to give them a chance to put a new ownership group together. So when the suit was filed, that bought them 6 months. Well, what that 6 months did was it bought them another season. So it bought them the 2019 season. Okay. Had they not had that 6 months and they didn't have a guarantee, because they wouldn't have been able to move. I mean, they wouldn't have been able to pick up and move and start again. So it guaranteed they'd have to stay here. So buying that time gave time for the new ownership group to come together. And it happened during that period of time. So without the lawsuit, you know, it was probably less than 50-50 chance that the crew could have stayed or would have stayed.
Do you think that sort of woke up the ownership group but the commissioner and Major League Soccer ownership is a little bit funny, but like the owners as a group, do you think they kind of went, whoa, I'm not sure if we really want to go here and actually test this?
Yes, you're so right. So you know how rumors go, but I had heard that Don Garber, the commissioner of MLS, he was getting calls from NFL owners, NBA owners, MLB owners saying, you got to stop this. You can't let this Modell Law thing affect whether or not an owner wants to move a team. You know, the precedent that's been set here now, it's going to make, I mean, the next owner that wants to pick up, you know, pick his team up and leave and go to another city, there's now a different precedent set. Now, not every state has a Modell Law, but, this now sets other wheels in motion, right? So, and who knows if it would have even held up in court? I mean, It had never been tested. It still really isn't, because it ended up being, everything ended up being dropped.
Yeah. Right. So let's go into the movement itself, which for some of us, I mean, like me up here in Canada, it was a hashtag and some news stories, but like on the ground level, what was happening? What was really happening to make this happen, to make this whole thing go?
So the night of the Grant Wall tweet, when the news hit that the team may leave, of course, just shattered the hearts of Crew fans. And the next night, they were planning a wake of sorts at a local pub, and they were just going there to drown their sorrows and commiserate. There's a picture in my book of actually a couple guys at the bar, just tears screaming down their faces that evening. But a fellow named Morgan Hughes, who ended up being the spokesperson for the Save the Crew movement, went to the bar, but he had a different idea. He said, we're not going to take this lying down. We're going to fight back, and we're going to organize, and we're going to do it in the right way. And so he went around the bar that night and went to every person and said, quit crying, stand up straight, puff your chest out, and we're going to fight this. We're going to come together and fight this. And it was that night that he registered on the Twitter account, Save the Crew, right? And the moniker Save the Crew began that evening. And the next day, as it got more and more traction online through social media, more people started hopping on saying, what can I do to help? And before you knew it, this, you know, this sense of despair had now turned into anger, but also action, that we're going to do everything we can to fight this. And so they mobilized, they started meeting, they started, you know, one of the first things was that Sunday there was a big rally at City Hall. 2,000 people came to the rally, and another 2,000 watched live on Periscope. And they had former players, they had city leaders, and they just said, we're not backing down, right? And the crowd chanted the Crew songs and everything, and that really set everything in motion. And that got the attention of other city leaders, and from that point on, I mean, Columbus was just full of Save the Crew. And there were 19 individuals specifically who came together to form the leadership group, but there were hundreds more volunteers that joined the effort to do, you know, we can get into it if you want, all kinds of activities that just kept it alive, kept the story alive, kept the pressure on the league, kept the pressure on the team, kept the pressure to find a new ownership group, so forth and so on. And they just never gave up.
Isn't this a soccer story? Like, I have trouble seeing, you know, well, Mark, you sent it out there today. The Oakland A's are going to start looking around because they're having trouble finding, you know, a deal for their new stadium or whatever. I can't see this happening in baseball, and I can't see it happening in football. But, you know, in soccer, it's almost like a totally different feeling. Like, you know, look at the – was that guy involved in the Super League at all in Europe? Because that lasted about, what, 4 days? and the fans there went nuts. And then suddenly everyone was like, wait a second, let's back up the bus. We better not do this.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, it was shocking to hear Columbus move because, you know, like I said, Columbus was the first major professional team in town. It helped maybe even bring in an arena, bring in National Hockey League, put Columbus on the map. But I guess my concern was, you know, you always heard that this was a great soccer facility. How has the facility changed for better or for worse since it opened 21 years ago?
Where the Crew play? Columbus Crew Stadium?
They're building a new stadium now, but at the time, was it that bad of a stadium? Did it need to be modernized?
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is he declaring an emergency? There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Tell us a little bit.
Well, it was built, you know, 26 years ago. No, it wasn't built 26. That's when the crew started.
99, I believe.
Correct. 99. So, and Lamar Hunt, we talked about, he was the owner. He really built it with his own money. So it wasn't this super, okay. I mean, not that he didn't have money, but so it was built on a budget, I would say. I don't want to venture to guess that I know the cost. I don't. I have a number, probably way off. It's kind of referred to as an erector set, though. You know, it's a lot of cement and brick and aluminum benches. Now, there are club seats and there are loges now and so forth. But, you know, it's the site of it is on the fairgrounds property. So it's where the Ohio State Fair is. So it's not, there's nothing around it really except parking lot. And they actually have to play elsewhere when the fair is in town. So, you know, because the Ohio State Fair is a big fair and it runs for 3 weeks. So they have issues there. And you know, there's no amount of renovating it would really help it at this point. But the other thing is, I mean, everything's going downtown, right? So
yeah.
Everybody wanted to be downtown. Precord wanted to be downtown, the other owner. And when the new owners came on board, they were going to build a downtown stadium, period. So the opportunity to build a new stadium and just make it absolutely, it's going to be state of the art. You know, it's going to be the finest stadium. You know, all stadiums catch up over time as the next new one comes on, but it's going to be as good as it gets. And I know you guys talked about, you know, coming to town and checking out a game later. The old stadium was, and they're going to keep the city and the county are going to own it, and they're going to house other things. There's, you know, there's concerts, there's high school football games, that kind of thing, and so forth that they'll have there. But it's solid. I'll give it that.
All right. So $28.5 million in 1999, and as we see with a lot of MLS venues and other venues, they wanted somewhere where it's walkable distance from fans who live around the area, bars and whatnot. So, exciting time. I was just a little bit shocked they're building a new stadium, but being that I've driven by it a few times and been inside, yeah, it does kind of have a very just basic. Basic feel to it compared to some of the new ones that they have out there in the MLS, which is a far cry to think that this is where the MLS is right now, these wonderful soccer-specific stadiums. So great to hear. But anything about the new stadium that you hear about that you're excited, looking forward to seeing this year?
It's just the fan amenities are just – again, state of the art, as classy as they can be in terms of the spaces and the clubs and the loges and so forth and the seating and it's just a beautiful stadium and a beautiful setting. We talked about the Nordeck, the north corner where all the fans, the supporter groups sit. They're building a whole section that's going to be just for them with, you know, to hang TIFOs and already ready to go with that. And so, you know, they've really tried to make it a place for them too. So it'll be interesting to see what the, what that group does with the new stadium when it opens. But Paul, you had your hand up.
I just wanted to say, you know, since you guys are getting a brand new soccer specific stadium in Columbus, we would be more than happy to take your old soccer specific stadium here in Boston.
What?
We've been trying for 20, when you, we said the MLS is 26 years old, we've been trying for 26 years to get a stadium up here for the Revolution.
You know, sometimes I hope it doesn't take what it took here, which is the threat of the team leaving. So,
well, since the Kraft own everything, so I don't think that'll happen.
You guys are going about it all the wrong. You got to go about it the Atlanta and Seattle ways. Like, come on, we just got to fill this up. It'll be perfect.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting, like, that the historic Crew Stadium is what they're calling it now, right? It was really the precursor for a whole lot of very similar things, right? Like, the Colorado was the same, and Real Salt Lake was the same, and Chicago Fire was the same. You know, but Dallas, we just want a stadium. We just want a stadium to call our own. Wherever it's going to be, it's going to be. Like, Colorado is out by, like, the nature preserve. Like there's nothing but wildlife refuge around where the Colorado Stadium is. And you know, Chicago Fire was out in Bridgeview. It's interesting that the evolution has sort of changed in that, well, it's not just going to be about wherever we can put the stadium now location. It's like a coming of age, right? Like now this right. league has made it so that location is important.
Yeah. I mean, remember when you guys know stadiums better than anybody. I mean, remember the old Richfield Coliseum in Northeast Ohio was in the middle of nowhere, and so it could draw from Cleveland and Akron and Canton.
Oh, terrible choice.
Yeah, stadiums and arenas used to be out, you know, I mean, some still are, obviously, but the trend certainly is moving downtown. So, you know, you're in an entertainment district and the new Crew Stadium is down the street from Nationwide Arena where the Columbus Blue Jackets play or hockey team plays and Huntington Park where our AAA Columbus Clippers baseball team plays. It's all on the same line on the same street in a marvelous entertainment district with, you know, restaurants and bars and retail and mixed use and commercial and residential, and it's one of the coolest areas in Columbus for sure, rivals probably any district like that, you know, as opposed to, you know, driving, you know, the current stadium is about just 3-4 miles north of downtown, but you know you park in a, you know, parking lot and there's nothing else around, and it's going to be a whole different feel. So, and that's certainly where all the trending is going in terms of stadiums, right? So,
Was it good for tailgating before a Crew game?
Yeah, in fact, some of the fans are concerned because it was perfect for tailgating because it had all the wide openness. Now there's not the central parking lot area and so forth, and you got parking garages you got to walk from. And so I'm not sure how they're addressing that, but we'll see. I'm sure they'll find their way.
They always do.
So Pete, what was the impetus to like put this all down and write it in a book that should be more available in Canada? Thank you very very much, by the way, for agreeing to send me one.
I've sent a few to Canada. I just sent one to Scotland too.
Wow.
So what got me started with the book, I was working on a different project that had to do with Columbus and working with a leadership group in Columbus, writing about different examples of what we call the Columbus Way, which you read about in the book. The Columbus Way is a moniker we use for how the public, private, civic, and now include grassroots sectors can all work together to accomplish great things. And so there were a number of specific stories I was delving deeper into in terms of case histories and so forth. And one of the things we wanted to write more about was the Save the Crew movement. So it was actually before the Crew was even saved, it was still thought of as a successful movement just in terms of the traction it got and so forth. Whether, I mean, obviously for them, failure was not, you know, an option. It was either win or nothing, but it still was a marvelous grassroots effort and how the entire city came together. So I started thinking about, you know, I started working on the case study, and I met Morgan Hughes, who I mentioned before. He's the spokesperson, and I was introduced to him. I didn't know Morgan. I knew of him. I'd seen him on TV because he's just been out there a lot. And, you know, we sat down, had a few beers, and talked, and I interviewed him, as I was doing with a lot of people at the time, and interviewed him again, and it was just kind of fun to hang out and drink with Morgan also, so I always was pulled back for that reason too. But the more I got to know the story and things I didn't know, even though I live here in Columbus and thought I knew more than most, I realized I didn't know anything. And what these people did was so remarkable. And so one time after several beers, I said to him, you got to write a book about this. And he said, heck no, he didn't use the word heck. I don't know if you can swear on this program. I'm sure we can, right? Right? I won't though.
Fuck thanks. Yeah.
Okay. He said, fuck no. I'd rather drink poison. You write it. And then, the rest is history. I actually had to meet with a leadership group who I didn't realize they were essentially a corporation. You know, they had board meetings and they were organized. And so I met with the leadership group and Morgan had just barely said, hey, I got this guy coming to our meeting tonight. And I think he wants to write a book or something. It was like really vague to them. And so I go to this meeting and, you know, I thought it'd be just a bunch of happy drunks, you know, like, hey. No, this was the most serious minded meeting I've ever been to. And they were asking me questions like, so you want to write our story? You want to write our book? What makes you think you can write our book? You've never written a book before? You want to write our book? You know, and I'm like, shit, man. I walked away from there thinking, I don't even know if I want to write this book now, you know. But they came back a couple weeks later and said, let's do it. And we did it. So wrote the book. It's right here, by the way.
There we go.
There's a way to plug it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You can go to a Save the Crew book. I know. Like August shows, you'll wrap up with where can I buy it, but SaveTheCrewBook.com and order it. But SaveTheCrewBook.com. But I got to be a marketer too. You know, I'm trying to sell it and things.
Absolutely.
No worries.
So that's how I came to write the book.
So of course, 2020 rolls around. Austin has got their own expansion team. It's an absolutely a crazy year. They're all playing at Disney for a tournament, and really sort of they were the first thing back. They were the first North American thing on television, right? I was watching Bundesliga soccer and where was that? Korean baseball, I think.
Yeah.
So what has been the response to winning the whole thing in the strangest year possible?
That crazy. Well, it was just, first of all, we started thinking how, I mean, within a year of, within, well, second year of the new ownership group, we win the cup, right? So, but doing it this year with COVID and everything, and by the way, I wouldn't recommend launching a book during COVID either. I launched a book on Labor Day where I couldn't even, like, you know, see anybody. Did a lot of this stuff. I did a lot of this stuff.
The pandemic has given us lots of authors on the show.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe it's just fitting that, you know, that we win the cup this year. You know, during COVID. I mean, it was the strangest thing watching I don't know if you watched the cup, the finals, but it was in Crew Stadium, and it was December, first Saturday of December, and not a soul in the place, you know? And under the lights, it was like, you know, 28 degrees, and, you know, it was, and they win the damn cup, right? 3-1, right? And the celebration and everything, and no one's there. And so you know, it was sad in the sense that after all this, the community couldn't have been there with them, and this gang of Save the Crew and all the fans couldn't have been there with them to celebrate. But they gladly took it. But it was surreal. I mean, the season itself would have been a great book, although I'm not writing another one about it. So
little chapter at the end.
We watched in my basement. I took my son. I actually wrote the review for the Crew in 2016. I took my son to Crew Stadium, and he decided that this was going to be his favorite team. So he was super excited. He was running around and in the basement. But the celebration is so bizarre, and it's the audio, right? Like, you're hearing 10 guys jumping up and down and screaming or whatever, but you're not hearing 30,000 or 25,000 or however many. Like, to me, that's the biggest thing that we've lost in the television experience, is that the audio is just not the same. It's not even close.
My son, he teased me all the time, because every time we're watching a game and there's no one there, I always have to comment on how weird it is. He's like, you got to say this every time. It's like, it just hits me every time. It's just how weird this is. And, you know, and you see like old replays of games replayed from years ago, and it's like surreal to think that really people shoulder to shoulder and spitting on each other and, you know, hugging each other. And now we can't do that. Hopefully we will be again soon. But, it's weird.
We don't even let our teams play up here. Like, you go down to Florida, it's safe there.
Yeah, safe there, right?
You go to the home that Beckham built. Actually, no, we're not there. We're in Orlando. Toronto FC is in Orlando. I think Montreal is playing in Miami. But, yeah, strange year. So, coming full circle, we're back to rebranding. Do you see a pattern here? I mean, me personally, I see a pattern. In my opinion, the last four rebrands in Major League Soccer have been
garbage.
You know, starting with the Chicago Fire one.
Oh, that's such an affront. And
which was one of the better logos. And then, I mean, Houston Dynamo. I don't like the one they have now, but the last one wasn't.
Did it get a lot of negative feedback? The Dynamo. I don't remember that as bad as Montreal.
Not as much. Not as much. And then Montreal, of course, being Club de Foot.
Club de Foot.
Like, you said, you were in.
Go ahead.
You were into marketing and branding. Like, would this be something you would even, you know, think about putting on your resume? Yes, I did rebrands for Major League Soccer.
Yeah, I did it as Snowflake.
I'll ask that in a second, but I got to share that. I think there's already a meme that it's the Chicago Fire fan saying, talking about how, like, nobody can ever top this, right? And the Columbus Crew, hold my beer.
Hold my beer, yeah.
You know, I think it seems to be, unfortunately, it seems to be a trend in MLS. You know, one of the things about the difference between North America and Europe, in North America, we call our teams by the mascots, by the, you know, the Bears, the Blue Jays, the, you know, the Crew, the Buckeyes, whatever it might be, the Browns. We don't generally lead with city as much, right? And maybe that's because many of our major league cities have more than one team. But even like, you know, universities, it's like, you know, we say let's go Bucks, not let's go Ohio State, right? And this whole trend, and I think was it like 14 out of the franchises now in MLS end with an SC or an FC. You know, they're you know, it's city, then FC or SC. Football club or soccer club, and it's truly the European model, right? And
definitely,
obviously, you know, does that mean that they want to take the league more global? You know, they talk about global reach. I mean, you know, even, I mean, any MLS team, especially in Columbus, talk about global reach. We want to be a globally recognized. I mean, that's a little bit of a stretch, right? But that seems to be the trend, and which creates a certain blandness to it, then it just really, you know, it's, I think it's disturbing for a lot of people. I don't know, you know, in terms of the efficacy of rebranding, I mean, usually you have to have pretty good reason to rebrand. And, you know, you could say a new ownership group would be a good reason to rebrand. I don't know. You can see why they might want to put their stamp on it, but you don't want to rebrand and lose all the best of your brand attributes along the way. And the two best brand attributes of the Columbus Crew, one of which is the name Crew, and the other which is just, it's the contrast of the black and gold.
Yes, and, definitely.
And both those things seem to be, they're still black and gold, but it's mostly gray and white and black and a little bit of gold. It seems like a misstep, right?
Yeah, I mean, I know when Cincinnati went from the USL Championship up into the MLS, they changed their logo, but people liked it. There was no complaints about that. Columbus Crew just had a perfect-looking logo. Some people even liked the original Crew logo with the three construction workers on it. But, yeah, I don't get this. I don't get this change. I don't get it right now. Usually teams make a decision in the off season and say, hey, this is our new logo. They sort of did this very sneakily. Like, we did stealthily. We didn't know about it. And
the
shape of the Ohio flag, which if you have to explain that to somebody, you know, it just seems like you have some little shapes and designs in there that are head scratchers. What they have now is brilliant.
Not even the exact shape of the flag that the triangle down at the bottom of the
stadium. Yeah,
then they have this odd-looking triangle filling up the space. And
does that mean anything? Have they explained that? Or
I haven't explained that.
Okay, I'm waiting for it.
My wife looked at it, and she was shocked. I was like, how did you get this guy? It's like perfect timing. I was like, hey, yeah, we're that good. We knew this was happening. Yeah. But she wants to know, like, why is that C pooping? What's up with that?
It's got like a goat's beard.
Then they tried to spin it, you know, the C in the middle. They said, well, that's we're leaning into Crew. That stands for Crew, so we're doubling down on Crew. Doubling down on Crew by just having letter C, which, by the way, we have Cleveland, Cincinnati, both with C's. I mean, what's my point?
Right. How much of this do you think is financial? Like, really? Like, is this – And not just with Columbus, but kind of across the board. Like, is this like a testament to, wait a second, maybe this league isn't really doing as well as we thought it was. You know, you look at who has rebranded Chicago Fire, Houston, Columbus, Montreal. We're not talking about, you know, the Sounders or Atlanta United or, you know, even TFC, like teams that are drawing in big crowds. These are the bottom. This is the bottom third. Like, do you think this is a financial push?
I think it is about money. I don't know if it's about money in the sense that because we're struggling and we need to do something different, as much as I think they see it as an opportunity to grow the brand, to grow beyond the attract a broader fan base. And, you know, I think in Columbus's case, I think the calculation they made was, you know, we know we're gonna piss off some diehards, some old people have been with us from day one. But for every one of those people we piss off, we're gonna gain three new fans. Now, I don't know how that works, but I think that's kind of the rationale I've read. And they think this will have a broader reach, and leading with the city is better for Columbus, but, you know, time will tell. But and then I think it has to do with, again, I think it has to do with the more European model and potentially trying to think of themselves as more global. You know, you look at the NBA and the NFL, they're trying it too. I mean, they've explored with that. That's tough, though. So I don't know how it works.
But, like, come on, let's be honest. Major League Soccer trying to build their brand globally is like the Korean baseball league trying to sell jerseys in the United States. Like, really? We're not talking about we're not talking about Manchester United and Real Madrid and, you know,
no.
We're not talking about those teams.
I know. I'm with you. I hear you.
I don't know. I don't get it. My son didn't like it either.
Is there any way back?
Bring her back. Yeah, I mentioned before we started the live that I thought there was a chance we'd wake up today and they would have pulled it back.
Yeah.
I thought there was a chance they would have done that yesterday. Cut your losses. We made a mistake. We effed
up.
Sorry. We miscalculated. You know, there's a better way to do this, and maybe there's a way to reach a balance here. And we, but I think they just doubled and tripled down. They had a meeting, another meeting yesterday or today, I think yesterday, with the supporter group, kind of an emergency meeting, where they tried to extend an olive branch. They, meaning the team, the front office, how do we work through this? And I think, you know, what I read was the supporter group said, it's all or nothing. You either scrap the whole thing or you don't come back from this. And they said, well, we're not doing that. And
wow.
So it ended rather contentiously, I hear. And then today you see that kits have been sent out and, you know, it's just they were ready to go.
Hey, so yeah. This story made it on the PTI rundown today. Right, yes, it did.
No, it's got a lot of national press, Sporting News, Sports Illustrated, ESPN. They've all covered it. I mean, some major publications, and
I'm hoping it's prolonged like the New York Islanders when they rolled out that fisherman, the Gordon's fisherman thing, and then finally they were like, okay. This is a bad idea. Here's the old stuff back. Like, I hope it's like, because like I'm a union guy. And even I don't like the union uniform. I think they're fine, but I'm just like the new one that came out with that, the yellow and the bright blue. I'm all about that one.
They just keep the snake, but there's too much going on in that.
Yeah,
logo.
I just don't, I can't say that. Like I said, it's out there now. It's on the podcast, but I've been kind of like, yeah, your jersey's great. But, you know, I come from I'll say it like this. Come from a family of firefighters. So I was real big on the Chicago Fire logo. And then they completely that offended me. And I have not seen the reaction to even that than I have seen on social media with the crew. It's unreal. And I back it because I think it sucks. It sucks. And just from a hypothetical, can you imagine if a team like if the Flyers tried something like that? They almost did it in the 90s. And this is unbelievable.
Teal.
And I can't believe they're going to add teal and flames and have a word mark. And it's like, no, we're not doing that. And I guess what I'm trying to say is I can't wrap my mind around team or ownership looking at the reaction going, F you, we're doing it anyway. I can't fathom that. I don't get it.
Well, I think it's going to be an interesting summer in Columbus if the fans are going to protest in some form. It's just going to tell you the dedication they have for a team that they saved.
People are getting vaccines. They're going to be walking down the streets again, like yelling stuff. Good job. Okay.
Yeah, and you know, here's the thing. The crew, that name's been around since 96. The Impact, that name predates the MLS 93, I believe. You know, these are names that have some merit. You know, they don't go back as far as, you know, the Manchester United Red Devils. But to soccer in this country, they mean something.
Well, it is like that. The soccer in this country, it is that.
It is that.
And you're going, like Dave was alluding to, without a warning, without a trace, just it's gone. There's no this was blowing my mind today. The last couple of days.
Should you guys have in Columbus have seen this coming when the kits for this year came out white and not yellow?
I think there was a hint that there would be some different branding over time. and maybe an evolution of some things, right? But to this degree, I don't think anybody saw this coming. No.
I happened to see a YouTube video of one of these super soccer guy and did a countdown of the kits for this year, and dead last was a white Columbus Crew home kit. And it was simply because white, it should be yellow.
Or goes gold. Back to what I said, it's the yellow and black. Like I said earlier, I feel bad for all parties because I know the front office and the new ownership group has the right intentions. They mean well. They want the same. They want the same results the fans want, right? You hope that this. If they don't change anything, you hope that it passes and fans are still fans, right? I mean, there are some fans on social media saying, "Hey, I'm still going to support this team. I'm angry right now, but it's such an emotional group and such an emotionally charged issue that you can't help but think that there hasn't been some permanent damage done, and they're going to have to continue to grow a different, grow a new fan base to make up for it. And how do you though replace your core supporters though? I mean, that's really the issue. And how do you take a chance on damaging your relationship with a group of individuals who are the very reason the team is still here. Right?
That doesn't seem a smartest business move, does it?
I'm just not getting past it. Like, and I understand ownership spent money, I get it at a basic level. I cannot fathom the money they spent, but at a basic level, I get that money and time went into this. But it's the blatant whatever, like to the fan base about it. It's almost unanimous. It's that close that it's not liked. Okay.
Yeah, I stayed up late Sunday night and last night just kept going through Twitter, just Instagram, and I just more and more and more and more, and it's just, oh my God, it's just,
What?
Yeah, I tweeted one thing about the book. I said, I did a word count in the book, and I said the word crew is in there 734 times. Just saying, And even that blew up. And it's like,
so we're splitting this house. I just had Kelly look it up. She said she liked it, so we're gonna not go talk to her.
No, she might be the first person. Has she seen the original logo?
Kelly's risking her sainthood here on that one.
You've seen the original one, right? You think that's
all right? So, Pete, since this is the Stadium Journey podcast, do you want to talk about any of your favorite places that you've seen in your sports fandom?
Oh, my favorite stadium.
We don't have to leave it to soccer. We can expand.
I'm glad that I was able to. In my younger days, go to Comiskey Park and Tiger Stadium.
Wow!
I'm glad I was able to see those stadiums.
Awesome.
Been to Dodger, been to old Yankee Stadium and new Yankee Stadium. There's no comparison.
No, there's not.
I haven't been to Fenway. Three stadiums I want to go to are Fenway, South Bend, Notre Dame, and Lambeau Field. Those are three stadiums I haven't been to.
I've been to all three.
It's hard to beat Ohio Stadium if you haven't seen a football game in Ohio Stadium. That's pretty cool. Been to Michigan. Michigan Stadium is pretty damn cool. Camden Yards is tough to beat. Wrigley. Been to Wrigley. Just the history. I'm a nostalgic guy, right? So
yeah, sounds like you like the old school places.
Yeah, I mean, old Yankee Stadium and thinking about. Babe Ruth and Willie and Mickey Mantle and so forth, and old Cleveland Stadium, old Municipal Stadium, Jim Brown and Otto Graham and Bob Feller. I just, listen. I know that's not progress, but maybe I'm not a progressive. But I just miss the smells of the cigars and the grass and the. I hate artificial turf. My sons, I'll tell you. I say it all the time. I cannot stand artificial turf. I need dirt and grass and grass stains and mud and weather. Hate domes. Yeah. So you've got some questions.
You've got some kindred spirits on this show, trust me.
But, like, the team can progress without having to build, like, a cookie-cutter stadium, you know? Like, you know, as a Phillies fan, I crap on Fenway just because it's the Boston Red Sox. But it's like, I would kill to see a game there because, and it's always rated high, Citizens Bank Park. But to me, it's, bleh, it's fine. Nothing wrong with it, but it's just like, oh, it's great.
What I mean, was it Veterans?
Veterans Stadium, yeah, the Vet.
Okay, so I saw a Phillies game there. I've seen a Reds game in Old Riverfront.
Yeah.
I saw a Cardinals game in their old Bush.
Bush.
And I saw, and I was at Three Rivers. So, and you're in those three stadiums, or four stadiums, and they're all exactly alike.
Yeah,
well, they're all gone now.
But, yeah, they're all good. Well, I used to go to the Vet with.
Thank God those are gone.
Yeah. Well, I used to go to the Vet with my dad, and he grew up in North Philly, and his grandfather used to take him to Connie Mack all the time to see the Phils games in the late 50s, early 60s before they moved to Jersey. And he's like, this we're talking about the Vet now, because that was a hole anyway. But he would just tell me, we beat the game and I'd be having a good time. He's like, this is nothing. You've never been. I'm like, why are you telling me that? They're like, God.
Well,
still like
better neighborhood.
I mean, like, like where the Browns play now, their stadium is first class, state of the art, great sidelines. Old Cleveland Municipal Stadium, there wasn't a good seat in that place for football. And I loved it.
Now, Baltimore has the distinction of having my least favorite and favorite venues in the same city. And that's my least favorite is the arena. Baltimore Arena is just, oh, God, just start over. Burn it down and start over. And Camden Yards is my favorite. It's my favorite stadium I've ever been to. I love that place.
Now, are you going to miss historic Crew Stadium? Or are you feeling a little bittersweet about?
I don't really have much of an attachment to that.
No attachment.
Well, there you go.
I mean, it's so generic, and it's not going anywhere. It's a great place to watch football.
I guess you're right, yes.
Let's see, that's progress. That's progress. Yeah. There you go. That's
progress, right.
Right,
yeah.
All right, Pete. I guess before we let you go, do you want to take a few minutes and plug your book and Save the Crew group and anything else that needs some promotion?
Then here it is. It's called Accidental Heroes, the grassroots movement that helped save the Columbus Crew. I have to change the subhead to help save the Columbus SC now, I guess. And you can get it on Amazon or at my website, SaveTheCrewBook.com. It's easy enough to remember. And I will say one more thing about the book. 10% of there's a great program called the Community Assist Program where they raise money and they buy tickets so they can send immigrant and refugee kids to games. Okay.
Oh, wow.
So 10% of the proceeds of the sale of the book goes to the Community Assist Program. So that's a nice kind of plug and benefit. But
mine's in the mail and I can't wait for it.
Well, make sure you let me know when you get it and what you think. And if you guys, the rest of you guys, Mark and Paul and Dan, you want a copy, let me know. And I'll arrange it.
Yeah. So I'll be hitting you up on Twitter.
All right. Pete, that sounds great to me. Thanks for coming on and
been a blast.
And sharing the story of the crew and the Save the Crew. I wish that we would have thought of that in Pawtucket because we could have saved the Paw Sox who are now opening tonight in Worcester.
I do think that the movement has revolutionized how fan bases may go about trying to protect their team from moving.
Yeah, stop taking teams. I mean,
it's the blueprint for it. Yeah,
absolutely. I just to tack on there. I think it's okay to question the ownership and the team when it, like for real issues like losing your team. You know. We could debate how good and bad social media can be on every separate occasion. But when it's fans trying to get the word to the teams, hey, we're not cool with this. That's a beautiful thing. I think that's a beautiful thing, especially nowadays.
Thanks again for coming on, and we look forward to catching the crew this season and beyond now.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
right.
Hey, that was Pete McGinty, Save the Crew, Accidental Heroes. I'm sorry, I'm screwing up the name of the book already.
Accidental Heroes.
Accidental Heroes.
He held the book up three times, Paul.
Accidental Tourist, Gina Davis.
If you could know the day I had today, you wouldn't understand why I can't.
Well, I was about to say, actually, I've read a label, I've read something, and I've gone to do it and gone, shit.
What was that?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, thanks for Pete to come. That was a great discussion, and I love that the fans were able to save the team. That just makes me feel good inside. So this is the part of the show where we recap our visits over the last couple of weeks. So, gentlemen, has anybody been anywhere since we all last got together?
Yes, I went to the grocery store, and I gave it a 2 out of 5. I've been holding on that for all year. All right, all pandemic I've been holding on that, and I got a groan. Okay.
Mark.
Well, I was supposed to go to...
You got muted laughter for me, Dan.
All right, thank you. Thank
I was
you,
supposed
thank
to go
you.
To the UFL baseball game, but I guess they have restrictions down there, which led to their head coach complaining about it on Twitter. But I did go to a college baseball game. I went to Butler University. When I arrived... there was security out there. They took my name down, wanted to know if I was for Butler or for the visiting team, Northern Kentucky. And they let me walk in, watch the game. Handful of people there, probably a normal crowd in any year, non-pandemic. But one thing I do like about going to the college games, the stadiums, you just hear all that chitter-chatter from the dugouts, both dugouts. The name-calling, the rallies, try to pick up the guys, you know, all that, hey, batter, batter, come on, he can't hit you, all this slang and lingo. It's kind of fun to hear that. Something you just don't really get at any level, not even minor league or some of these bigger college facilities. So 500-seat stadium, very relaxed, free of charge, no concessions. I don't think they ever sell any concessions there. So it wasn't as if that experience this year was any different from other experiences. So if you happen to be in the neighborhood, it's worth checking out on a nice day. Other than that, it's probably just for the diehards. But that was my visit. So check out the video this Thursday on my YouTube channel, Ballpark Hunter.
Nice. And we actually did our first road trip since January of 2020. We decided, you know what, we're both vaccinated. Things are getting better. Rates are going down here in New England. So we went to one of my favorite cities in the world to go to, and that's Portland, Maine. So what we did is we went up for 3 days, left on Friday, came back on Sunday. And while we were up there, we actually caught a Maine Nordiques hockey game.
Woo!
Yeah, the North American Hockey League, so Tier 2 junior hockey. The Maine Nordiques play in the Colisée, which is located in Lewiston, Maine, about half an hour, 45 minutes north of Portland. It is probably best known as the site of the Muhammad Ali-Sonny Liston fight back in 1965. Now, if you take a look at this place, you're like, how in the world was the heavyweight title fight in the 60s fought at this place, this 4,000-seat arena in Lewiston, Maine, this run-down old factory town? It also produced one of the most iconic pictures, sports pictures of all the time. You know, the picture I'm talking about was Ali standing over, and he's got his fist like this, and Liston is out cold on the ground, and Ali is just hovered over him. That picture was taken at the Lewiston Colisée.
Well, you're not going to ask how. Why was that held there?
It was originally supposed to be held, I believe, in Boston, but it got moved for some reason. I'm sorry, I'm not prepared with the backstory. But,
well, I'm going to guess because of the time. Well, I'll take a guess in my own mind. Never mind.
Well, in the 60s, yeah, probably had to do with the racial.
We should probably move this.
The racial atmosphere in the city at the time, yeah. So, yeah, it ended up being held in Lewiston, Maine, of all places. So, yeah, this little 4,000-seat venue was the last weekend of the regular season for the North American Hockey League. So they just opened the doors. Fans could come in for free. I'd say about 200 people came in. I have no way of knowing if that's their regular crowd or not for North American Hockey League. It could be their regular crowd. They also had a fundraiser going on for therapy dogs in the area. So there were also about a dozen dogs wandering the place. And that was the highlight for me because I just wanted to pet all the dogs.
Yeah, thank you.
They were therapy dogs, so they were all well-behaved.
I bet you there were no dachshund therapy dogs.
No, they were all kind of like labs.
Yeah. Retrievers. Yeah. Yeah. Dachshunds can't be therapy dogs in that way.
And my favorite one was Buster. He was a three-legged old guy. He was awesome. He was so sweet. He came and sat and watched the game with me for a little while. So we did that on Friday night. And then Saturday and Sunday, in between eating every piece of seafood that I could find in Portland, we caught a couple of Sea Dogs games over at Hadlock. Now, we've talked about Hadlock Field here, so I won't really get into it much. But what was weird were the restrictions they had in place. Now, we were all on the same boat at where we encourage everybody to be smart, be safe. And there is being smart. And then there was what I experienced at Hadlock Field this weekend. The restrictions they had in place were crazy. They had, I think they could see about 2,800 fans in this stadium, which usually seats about 6,500. And the seats that they had all the seats measured out. So no one could possibly be within 6 feet of each other unless you're in the same group. They had all the seats zip tied. They had zip ties on the bleachers so you couldn't sit in the wrong spot. They had Hadlock Field basically has one entrance in and out. For right now, they have four entrances. So you can come into weird areas of the ballpark to go in, and you have to go right from the entrance to the seat. Concession stands are closed. The team store is closed. If you wanted food, drink, merchandise, you had to order it on your phone from your seat, and they would deliver it to you. So the only reason you could get up was to go to the bathroom. Otherwise, you had to stay in your seat.
That both makes me comforted and terrifies me.
Well, you know what? And that's all well and good. And you had to, in the case of overkill, then you also had to have your mask on at all times. So if I'm socially distanced, I'm outside, and I can't move from my seat, why do I have to have my mask on?
But then
game's over. You know what happens. Everybody up, everybody out at the same time. So much for all the social distancing you were doing all day. It was great. Great to be back at the ballpark. I had a great time, but it was also strange to have those kind of restrictions. And you know what it taught me? Boy, I love wandering around the ballpark. It was kind of hard to just sit in my seat. I felt like a kindergartner with ADHD.
I was
squirmy. I think I took 3 bathroom trips just to get up out of my seat, just to stretch my legs. So that was my weekend. Always love going to Portland. Like I said, one of my favorite cities. So
and that thing with ballparks. Some ballparks they're a little more lax in their restrictions, and others are lockdown. So. I'm looking at going to the Victory Field this weekend. I've been there several times for other events during the pandemic, so I'm sort of interested how that's going to look like. So
it's funny. I was discussing some of these precautions with some people in a Facebook ballpark group, and one of the guys just said, "Hey, come on down south. We'll show you what freedom's all about."
Florida.
If you're going down south, it's going to be a little bit different.
If I could cut the stems from my eyes just to roll them in the back of my head. Yeah, as Matt says in the chat, air moves. I'm really looking forward to seeing how venues are going to be, because I got tickets to 2 Genesis shows in November, December, and they're being selling all those tickets.
I think by then, Dan, it's going to be business as usual.
Oh, sure. And I think we'll be able to, for the most part. I really do. I really do think what I was saying at the beginning of all this, that the good will overpower the bad.
Well, let's hope so.
It's going to take a slug, and it has been a goddamn slug through all of this. But I think we'll be okay. And again, on record, if I don't see Ghostbusters in November, we're going to have problems.
Wasn't that supposed to be out last year?
Last June.
Yes.
Yes. Let me remind you.
Okay. So that's where we're going to wrap it up for tonight. Once again, thanks to PET for joining us. That was a great conversation. I loved it. Dan, where can our listeners follow you online?
DanLaw83.
Mark, do you have any stadium journeys planned for the next couple of weeks? And where can our listeners follow you?
Yeah, I plan on hitting Victory Field here in Indianapolis.
Fort Wayne. Would love to take a drive down to Louisville to check out some of their ballparks and soccer stadiums. They have a new female, new girls team, women's team called Racing Louisville.
NWSL.
NWSL. Apparently playing with some great crowds with a nice logo that everybody likes.
For now.
They try to change Louisville City's logo, the men's team, and they had an uproar. They changed it back. We'll talk about that another time. But, yeah, check out my travels, Ballpark Hunter, on Twitter, Instagram, and on my YouTube page. Subscribe, like, comment.
I said what I said, Badass.
Dave, where can our listeners follow you online?
On Twitter at Profan9. We got an Obstructed Views coming out next week, a special one. It's going to be on the Cleveland Indians. The literary journey continues. Just finished up Buffalo, Home of the Braves, all about the Buffalo Braves. That was pretty interesting. We're talking about bad ownership. Now, there was some bad ownership. And I pulled this one, really old, surprisingly interesting, called Build It and They Will Come. And it's all about how the Tampa Bay Rays came to be. And just fascinating how two cities, St. Petersburg and Tampa, can be like just so against each other. But look for my comments on that on Twitter at Profan.
And you can follow my stadium journeys on Twitter or Instagram or YouTube at PuckManRI. Like Mark said, like, comment, share, all that good stuff. Support our work. We enjoy that so much. Over the next couple of weeks, I do have a trip planned, and you may or may not be surprised where I'm going. I'm going to Polar Park this weekend, baby, to check out the new home of the Worcester Red Sox, the Woo Sox, and I'm going to go see Smiley Ball and punch him right in his smiley face. Yes, their mascot's name is Smiley Ball.
For legal reasons, he's kidding.
Yes.
For comedy reasons, he's not kidding.
That's not a funny one.
No, that was right on the money, I think. I've seen it. Ugh.
Yes, yes, Steve. Oh, you'll leave? All right,
good night, folks.
Dave's out. Don't forget to check out the website, stadiumjourney.com. Follow us on Twitter. Follow us on Instagram at Stadium Journey. And subscribe to the YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook as well. You can find the Stadium Journey podcast at vocnation.com. Or, if you can't remember that, just search VOC Race, VOC Nation Radio Network on your podcast app. Remember, we simulcast live every other Tuesday night at 8 Eastern at twitch.tv/StanLaw83. Hey, we'll be back in 2 weeks, May 25th. We will be joined by Zach Fish, the play-by-play announcer for the Hershey Bears. He will be joining us to talk about the just-completed and most interesting American Hockey League season.
Kelly will be there, whether she knows it or not.
So, for Ted Calachico, for Mark Viquez, and Dave Cotney, I'm Paul Baker.
Cross the desert, bear man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been everywhere.
This is Matt Hardy, and you are listening to the VOC Nation.
Rock and Roll Union and North Step Productions, in conjunction with Boo Ray Atlantic City, proudly present Jersey Shore Jam 2. May 15th, featuring As We Become Ghosts and Rat Rod. It's been a long, cold winter, and now it's time to rock. Also appearing, the Rock and Roll Union House Band, Shades of Grey, playing all of your favorites from the 60s to now. All COVID regulations will be in place. Tickets are available at Eventbrite.com and are extremely limited, so get them before they run out. Doors open at 6 and showtime is at 7. Rat Rod, As We Become Ghosts, and Shades of Grey. Jersey Shore Jam 2, May 15th at Blu Ray, 201 South New York Avenue, Atlantic City. Did I mention there's free parking? Don't miss it.
Rock and Roll Union for the past 2 years has been the place for rock and roll, new rock and roll, debuting rock and roll, and some of the old classics as well. We have welcomed guests from around the world, national artists and more. We have excited many people by our live events. We've welcomed everybody into the fold, and we continue to do so on a weekly basis. Guys, that is Rock and Roll Union, and that is what we do for you.
Saturdays, 6 p.m. Eastern, VOCNation.com.
Since 2012, HIAC Talk Radio has been bringing you the best of independent wrestling and wrestling on the worldwide scale with interviews and other segments now featuring The Wrestling Historian with Craig Ligon every Thursday night at 6 p.m. at VOCNation.com or go to your Android or iPhone and type in VOC Nation Radio Network and subscribe to the greatest wrestling podcast network in the world. Listen to HIAC Wrestling Podcast today.
VOC Nation provides live daily streaming shows where fans have the ability to interact with the hosts and guests by phone call, email, and Twitter. VOC Nation hosts include the legendary Ken Resnick, who you probably remember from the AWA and WWE, former WCW performer The Maestro, Wes Briscoe, who you probably remember from Impact, Brady Hicks, who you remember from Pro Wrestling Illustrated, former WWE and TNA star Shelly Martinez, and former Philly radio personality Bruce Wirt. VOC Nation's two most popular shows are Wrestling with History, featuring Ken Resnick and Bruce Wirt, streaming live on Wednesday nights at 9:30 Eastern, and of course, In the Room, featuring Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Brady Hicks and WCW alum The Maestro. And by the way, both of these shows take callers live during the show. What are you waiting for? Go listen live right now at VOCNation.com and subscribe to all of our podcasts by searching for VOC Nation Radio Network on your favorite podcast app. Oh, and follow them on Twitter, too, at VOC Nation.
Hola, this is your amiga, Shelly from Cali, to let you know you can catch me here on VOC Nation for Shelly Live. You never know what the hell I'm going to be talking about. Sometimes I have guests. Sometimes I let you on in the cheese mess, spill a little tea. Sometimes I cry. You have to tune in to find out why. And I also take your calls. I love chatting with you guys and seeing what the hell you guys are thinking. So meet me here on the VOC Nation. Be there or be square.
The worldwide leader in entertainment. This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.